Good evening. And tonight we've got a very interesting show lined up. We're going to be talking about the mysterious face on Mars and whether or not this face is the result of artificial or alien intelligence creation or if it's a natural phenomena. But first we're going to go to Chris O'Brien, who is going to give us an update on the mysterious San Luis Valley of southern Colorado. And as we have mentioned before, this is going to be a regular feature on the Paranet UFO Continuum. There seems to be a considerable amount of activity, and Chris is the lead investigator down there. He's done a considerable amount of work over the years, investigating a whole slug of things, which the San Luis Valley contains all of the elements of the UFO phenomena, abductions, cattle mutilations, or as Chris calls them now, cattle deaths, mysterious cattle deaths, and Bigfoot, you name it, they've got it. Our guest tonight is also going to be Professor Emeritus and former Chairman, Department of Philosophy of Sonoma State University, Stanley McDaniel. And what Stan is going to talk about tonight is a condemning report that he wrote of NASA and their irresponsible behavior dealing with the Mars face and the Cydonia complex and the pyramids, et cetera, et cetera. This is going to be a very interesting program, and I'm going to get into this after the break. What does this have to do with UFOs? I think you'll find it pretty intriguing. And for most of you out there, I bet you don't know what June 24th was. June 24th marks the 47th anniversary of what most consider the modern era of ufology. What happened on that date in 1947, you might ask? Kenneth Arnold reported observing from his small plane nine objects maneuvering around the Yakima Mountains in Washington State. It was Kenneth Arnold who coined the phrase flying saucers, of which the press picked up and popularized that phrase. And just a few short days later, beyond this, in 1947, we got the report of the mysterious crash at Corona, or better known as the Roswell incident. So June 24th, 1947, is the 47th anniversary of what we call modern ufology. Okay, we're going to move into the mysterious San Luis Valley, and our guest is Chris O'Brien. Good evening, Chris. Did we lose Chris? Okay, we got to redial him real quick here. He seems we seem to have lost him. Let's talk a little bit about this. What we're going to talk about, the subject of the show tonight, and that is the face on Mars. And a lot of people probably have heard at some point, about this anomaly. Mark Carlotto and Vincent DiPietro brought that interesting data to the public forum back in 1980, I believe it was 87. Might have been a little bit earlier than that. But they discovered in 1976 when the Viking mission went to Mars to map the surface of Mars and take some pictures of it, they discovered an interesting anomaly in a couple of the frames, and one of them being this face, what appears to be a humanoid face, or as some people say, simian, meaning monkey face. And in further study, they discovered off to the area of that what they found to be like a five-sided pyramid and a complex, perhaps a city. This thing has, created a huge debate within NASA and the civilian scientific community. And a lot of people are aware that NASA has pretty much denounced the whole idea as just a trick of light and photography. So, there's no way that NASA is going to even acknowledge that there is anything there. Richard Hoagland, as many people probably know, published a book called The Monuments of Mars several years ago. And in this book, he talked about the discovery that these guys had made. Now, before we get into this, I wanted to make note that this is not tabloid material. Despite the fact that a lot of you have seen the Martian stuff on Weekly World News or U.S., World Inquirer or whatever the heck that is. And it is important to note that the people that have been behind the research of this anomaly on Mars have been people who have serious scientific credentials. Now, you might ask, what does this have to do with UFOs? The reason that I'm bringing this up is because it has everything to do with it. Number one, the reason that for the reason of public policy, the way that the government deals with such things as UFOs or the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence or something like that. You know, over the years, we've been conditioned as the public, of the general public, to believe that a lot of this stuff is bogus. It's material that needs to be debunked. It's not worthy of any study, despite the fact that several hundred thousand people over the years have reported seeing UFOs. Now, I think most people will agree that the government may have a secret portion of the government that is researching this stuff and trying to determine, you know, what is really going on. So there really is some kind of research going on in the background. Despite that, now I guess what comes to mind with that is MJ-12 and this thing about MJ-12 being a covert group in the government that's responsible for working with the Roswell debris and the bodies that were recovered at Roswell. Despite that fact, let's move into NASA. NASA is an agency that has been charged with exploring space for peaceful purposes or whatever, and they constitute basically the scientific community. As far as I'm concerned, when you talk about science, it doesn't matter what it is, the truth is the most important part of it. However, as you're going to see tonight demonstrated with our guest, Professor McDaniel, NASA has made a terrible failure of executive, congressional, and scientific responsibility in investigating possible evidence of artificial structures on the surface of Mars and in setting mission priorities for NASA's Mars exploration program. And what we're going to see demonstrated in that is that as far back as the early 60s, NASA was meeting to determine what the public policy should be as to what would happen if a discovery was made that indicated that we were not alone, that there was something beyond the Earth out there. And I think the findings will surprise you. This is something that is part of a publicly available paper, a NASA technical document. And I think that, you know, it will surprise you that just how little confidence they have in the public and our ability to know or understand the truth. But what infuriates me even more is the whitewash that goes along with it. And so that's going to be the subject of our program this evening. What's going on down in the mysterious San Luis Valley?
Well, things have quieted down a little bit since the end of May. We have some additional reports, though, from the May and April time period that are being investigated. And I'll tell you, things are really hopping around here the first weekend of May through the second weekend of May. And we had a lot of activity also in April.
Okay.
And, you know, we're just getting more and more corroborating reports from people all over the valley. It's not any specific area, really, that's seen the activity. It's pretty commonplace all around the valley.
Okay.
And things have quieted down the last couple of weeks or so, which gives me a little time to go ahead and investigate the stuff from the previous 2 months.
Have there been any mysterious cattle deaths recently?
Yes, we've had some reports coming out of New Mexico that until I get real verification and talk to the principals involved, they're still unsubstantiated. I do have a case from the Fort Morgan area, which is near Denver in Adams County.
Yes, northeast.
A very bizarre steer death there that was investigated by the local sheriff and a vet. And does have the, you know, has that curious downwind to Denmark smell to it. Animal was exhibited your classic mutilation-type incisions. And I asked if they had seen any unusual aerial activity as, you know, one of my standard stock questions. And the rancher said that he had heard of some sightings. He personally, he and his family hadn't seen anything. But it does seem to me that we do have a lot of military-type activity going on here in the San Luis Valley and other parts of Colorado. We've seen they shipped our National Guard out towards the end of May and then subsequent to Kansas for maneuvers, and then we saw convoys here in the valley of other military-type vehicles. And you know, one always does wonder whether these things are all tied together, and it would seem pretty interesting to me that they would ship the National Guard, the local National Guard unit out, and then bring in convoys of other military vehicles.
That's pretty interesting,
so,
sure.
I don't know. Your guess is probably as good as mine.
I understand you're doing or handling tours down there. Are you still doing that?
Yes, I am. As a matter of fact, I've got a gentleman here this weekend.
Okay. Why don't you give our listeners an idea how they can get in touch with you?
Well, if you've got a pen, just jot my name down, Christopher O'Brien. And you can put the Mysterious Valley on there, too. It's P.O. Box 223, Crestone, C-R-E-S-T-O-N-E, Colorado, 81131. And I'd be happy to send any of your listeners some material documenting some of our recent activity and then some information about my tours and other projects that I'm involved in.
Okay. How often do you publish your newsletter?
Bi-monthly.
Bi-monthly. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great, Chris. Okay, we'll catch up with you next week and see where we go from there.
Okay, Michael.
Okay, you take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Chris O'Brien. He is the lead investigator down in the San Luis Valley of Colorado, southern Colorado. And there's been a lot of activity going on down there. And we continue. Tonight, our guest is Professor Emeritus and former chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Sonoma State University. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Stanley McDaniel. Stan, are you there?
Yes, I am, Michael.
Good evening, and thank you for being on our program this evening.
More than glad to be here.
Now, there's a lot of ground to cover here, and not much time, unfortunately, but I've read the 200-page report that you have written. It's called the McDaniel Report, mm-hmm. and it is available for $20 to people who wish to order it, and we'll get to that information toward the end of the program. But I want to say this. I find it to be a profound indictment of NASA's inability or irresponsibility in dealing with science. And I want to start off by, you know, shaping this this concept for the listeners this evening.
Surely.
I guess where this comes to the head has to do with the Mars Observer. I guess everything swirls around this right now. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay, give us a little background about that.
Well, I think most of the public know that the Mars Observer was a spacecraft sent out to Mars and supposed to arrive there around August of 1993 and suddenly went silent inexplicably just as it was about to go into orbit around Mars. It had all the instructions for going into orbit automatically uploaded to the spacecraft prior to its loss. And when we say its loss, we mean that NASA reports no further radio transmission from it.
Now, normally that would be, I guess, just a routine. Don't want to say routine when you have a failure of any kind of a hardware, expensive hardware like this. I guess you can't say it's routine, but any other time, you know, it would be attributable to possibly, you know, hardware problems. But this particular mission is quite different. Richard Hoagland has leveled a charge that there has been some hanky-panky with the Mars Observer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you detail that?
Well, in my report, I believe I developed enough information to make the circumstances surrounding the loss of the spacecraft very suspicious, appear very suspicious.
Okay.
However, I don't have any data, and neither does anyone else, because NASA turned off the radio on the spacecraft shortly before it was to go into orbit. The alleged reason for this was to avoid damage to some sensitive parts of the radio when they had to fire some bolts.
Was this a routine procedure, or was this something that was
No, it was not routine. As far as I know, they've only done this once in the entire history of the space program. And that is one of the bases upon which Richard Hoagland believes that there was something very suspicious about it. But I haven't gone so far as Hoagland has. He at least strongly suggests that NASA has deliberately cut the spacecraft off from public knowledge and is receiving messages from it clandestinely I have no way of determining that, so I've left it an open question.
Is that kind of a thing possible?
Oh yes, it's certainly possible. There isn't any technical reason they couldn't do this. They have antennas, I believe at Goldstone, that are dedicated antennas to black box operations and so on. It's not an impossibility at all.
So it would not be a very difficult procedure for them. Say, like, for example, when they sent up the shuttle, there's some shuttle missions that are classified military operations, and then there are others that are civilian. I would assume that the communications are handled differently for each one of those types of missions, correct?
It would be, yes.
Okay. That's very interesting. Okay, now let's discuss NASA. The report, your book details a 1960 report titled The Proposed Studies on the Implications of Peaceful Space Activities for Human Affairs.
Yeah, the Brookings Institute report.
Okay, explain for our listeners what that report entailed and why does it seem to reverberate all the way into 1994?
Well, let me just prelude this by saying I didn't start out to write a book that indicts NASA in any way.
Okay.
I certainly had some skepticism about what was going on, but what I uncovered in a year and a half of careful research was much more startling than I had thought. And along the lines of this, as I progressed, I uncovered, due to the help of some friends who were working on this with me, that back in 1960, a report had been prepared at the request of NASA by the Brookings Institution in Washington, and this report was on the peaceful uses of outer space. It has a section in it on the what to do in the event of extraterrestrial discovery. And in that section, the report very seriously talks about the possibility that within the next 20 years after the report came out, which would have been about 1980 actually, they thought that it was not at all unlikely that some evidence of former civilizations or habitation, might be found on some of the planets of the solar system. And they specifically mentioned the Moon, Mars, and Venus. At that time, they didn't know that Venus's temperature would be pretty prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
But the shocking part of the report, or the part that is highly interesting, is that they said that scientists might be devastated by the knowledge that a superior civilization may have existed, even if it was in the past, and that the powers that be might want to withhold information on such a discovery from the public, at least that they would perhaps want to consider it, because it could cause such public unrest.
I think that's a complete contradiction to the tenets of scientific inquiry, though, isn't it?
Of course it is. That's why my book raises this as an ethical issue.
Okay, now, Stan, let me ask you this. NASA's job is not to set policy, is it?
Well, I wouldn't think so, no. I mean, of course, there's internal levels. I mean, NASA's given general guidelines, and they have policies they can set internally.
But policies that actually deal with, well, for example, now the SETI program. I notice you've got some mention of SETI in here.
Yes.
The SETI program. Now I've read the protocols that they established with the SETI program.
Yes.
SETI, for those who don't know, is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It's a large listening project that listens to signals in outer space to determine if there's any intelligent signals there, or if it's just space noise. But essentially, the SETI program had developed some protocols that outlined the way that they were going to handle any contacts that they received. Now, the thing is that how can they withhold information and establish policy to do that?
Well, I haven't seen the NASA SETI protocol, if there is one. I'm not aware of it. I assume they must have something.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an international protocol drawn up by several bodies of scientists that have to do with the use of outer space. And in that international protocol, the general drift of it is that there should be full public exposure of any knowledge. However, they do have safeguards built in to ensure that there isn't a false alarm, as it were.
Right.
And there's a fine line between withholding the information because they want to make sure it's not a false alarm, maybe withholding it for years, who knows,
mm-hmm.
And actually giving it to the public. So as I've read that protocol, it looks to me like there are some loopholes in it that still would interfere with getting the information to the public.
Okay, all right. 1-800-836-2009 is our call-in number. 1-800-UFO-2009. My guest tonight is Professor Stan McDaniel. Stan has written a book called The McDaniel Report. It's regarding the failure of NASA to address the scientific evidence concerning an alleged face or an alleged, as they call it, the AOC or the, let's see, like recall, that's the artificial origin at Cydonia hypothesis.
Yes, the AOC hypothesis.
Right. Okay. Stan, go into the, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is again, Stan McDaniel is a very serious person who has credentials. This is not a tabloid in any way, despite the fact that a lot of this stuff appears in the tabloid newspapers. There really are scientific people that are working on this. And Stan, bring us up to date on that.
I'd like to. Let me mention, by the way, that one of the characteristic approaches that various NASA personnel have to this is to try to brand anyone who even so much as hints that there might be something artificial up there on Mars as a tabloid journalist and an irresponsible person who's out to make a lot of money from gullible listeners.
Which essentially is what they've done with Richard Hoagland, correct?
Yes, they've wiped him out practically in many ways with that, although he hangs in there. But they finally started attacking me on that basis, too, when
okay.
my report came out.
All right.
Now, when I say that, I mean particular NASA personnel. I'm not talking about NASA policy, but it's sometimes hard to tell the difference. But my book began as an effort to look at the research that has been done by independent scientists and look at it from the point of view of what's called philosophy of science, that is, the study of scientific method, and whether it's done properly or done irresponsibly. What I found was that the scientists looking at the data from the old Viking photographs, the independent people, which included Richard Hoagland, but also several other quite reputable scientists, that they had followed very careful procedure, doing everything that scientists are supposed to do. For example, outlining their techniques and their procedures so that others can duplicate them. Whereas NASA has treated it, I like to use the word, cavalierly. That is to say, they really haven't done any scientific study of this. I've had NASA people try to deny this to me on the air, as a matter of fact, but the fact is that there does not exist a single written study of these objects using state-of-the-art methods of computer enhancement by NASA or any establishment scientific body other than the independent investigators.
So what you're saying then is a lot of NASA's own proclamations to the contrary are based upon just what? Nothing?
They're based upon nothing. That's absolutely correct. There is going to be an article coming out in Omni magazine next month. It's their August issue. It's available on the newsstands next month. And in that they quote a NASA scientist as saying, and I'll quote this for you, just a moment, I have the article, I have a proof of it. Michael Carr, who is a geologist with NASA, is quoted as saying, "Not one person of scientific credibility believes this." Now, there's two things about that I point out. First of all, no one has asked anyone to believe that there are artificial objects on Mars. The NASA people repeatedly try to cast the problem as though someone's trying to get you to believe the truth of something.
Mm-hmm.
But we're working with science here, and you have a hypothesis. And the only issue here is whether it's possible that there are artificial objects up there.
Which I think is a very responsible way to approach it.
Right. That's the way to go at it. And so that's one thing. But the second thing is when he says no person of scientific credibility. Well, I am now working with a group of as many as six or seven very reputable scientists who are very interested in this subject and are exploring the geology and the physics and the astronomy of this area in Mars. And every single one of them are qualified scientists, and they give the lie to what Mr. Carr is saying.
Okay. And we continue with our guest, Professor Stanley McDaniel. Stan is discussing the Mars Observer, the Martian face, and NASA's alleged attempt at trying to force the big green weenie on us to the tune of about $1 billion when they lost the Mars Observer spacecraft. Stan, going back to this discussion of the people that have been involved in this project over the years that have brought us this information about the face and the complex and everything, you yourself, being a scientist, you have looked and reviewed their work. Is that correct?
Well, let me make one correction there. It isn't really accurate to call me a scientist.
Okay.
I am a philosopher.
Right.
And philosophy consists in large part, or one aspect of philosophy, is the critique of science and also of logic and ethics. And that's the approach I've taken toward this subject.
Okay. Now, I noticed here Mark Carlotto, Vincent DiPietro. Now, are those guys scientists?
Well, certainly. Carlotto is a Ph.D. who's has a long background of professional experience in image processing. He's written many professional papers on image processing and the use of computer enhancement. Vincent DiPietro is an engineer, and some people say engineers are not, strictly speaking, scientists, but they are professionals, experts in their field. And just taking DiPietro, for example, and his partner or his associate in this, a man named Gregory Molinar, both of whom were engineers at the Goddard Space Flight Center at the time of the research, they developed new techniques for enhancing spacecraft images to give a better result. And these techniques were thoroughly tested, and in fact they won an award from their company for having done so. And the technique they developed is now currently in use in a number of earthly applications.
So these guys are not lightweights.
No. These are people who know what they're doing.
Okay. Now, let's discuss the Mars Observer. I know that there was an incredible amount of controversy surrounding who was going to take the photographs, if any photographs were to be made.
Yes.
And what the disposition of those photographs was going to be was left up to someone in the private sector. Is that correct?
This is the central focus of attention at this point on the political front and the ethical front. There is a system by which NASA makes arrangements with private individuals who will develop and place experiments on the spacecraft. They call these people the principal investigators, and they have contracts with them. The contracts usually include a proprietary period during which the scientist involved has exclusive use of the data. And then after that period, the data can be released to the general public. However, with the Mars Observer, for the very first time on any spacecraft mission, the camera was given over to a principal investigator. That was Dr. Michael Malan. And in this case, Malan then has the right to keep data in the form of images of Mars from the public for a period of as long as 6 months after they are received. Now, that doesn't mean we necessarily get photos 6 months after the Mars Observer went into orbit.
What was their reasoning for this? I mean,
well, the reasoning is simply that they say that the person who spent all the time and trouble developing the experiment has a right to publish the first papers and get the first credit.
Does that mean that Malan has any money involved in this, or has he just got time?
I can't say authoritatively all the details, but Malan did form a private company. He left Arizona State University, at least on leave, and formed a private company called Malan Space Science Systems Incorporated, moved them to San Diego, California, and theoretically would stand to profit, I believe, if he ended up being the first person show pictures of artificial objects on Mars.
1-800-836-2009, 1-800-UFO-2009. Give us a call. Stan, back to Dr. Mallon, though.
Yes.
I got a question. When did NASA, or maybe this has been something for a long time. I'm kind of a layman at this, so you have to excuse the question. It seems dumb. But has NASA always let contracts out to private contractors?
I don't know how long they've been doing it, but it is a common practice. NASA does something very strange when people question this on the part of the Mars Observer protocol. They say, well, we're doing it the same way we've always done it. And that's true in the technical sense that for private contractors like Michael Malin, they're doing it the same way they always have. But the fact of the matter is that it isn't the same way in that the camera has never been under the auspices of a principal investigator before. Let me, if I may, just mention another problem with this. NASA people have repeatedly said that they have no authority over Dr. Malin as to what he chooses to photograph or what priorities he gives his photographic mission. That is very hard to believe. We've been trying to get a hold of the contract between Malin and NASA. There's been a lot of trouble doing that, by the way, but it looks like maybe it'll be obtained eventually.
Is there any particular reason why it's so hard to get a hold of?
Yes, there's another little technicality. Although JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab, is a NASA facility, what they say is that the physical plant of JPL belongs to NASA, but the contracts belong to Caltech because JPL is manned by Caltech personnel. And so the contract with Malin is between JPL and Malin, not between NASA and Malin. And Caltech being a private organization, the Freedom of Information Act does not apply. So it's only out of Caltech's good graces if you manage to get a copy of the contract.
Interesting, very interesting. Let me ask you another question, and this is something that I know a lot of people have on their minds. Is there a possibility that you know, you hear all, I'm not a conspiracy theorist myself, but I hear a lot of these stories, and it makes you wonder sometimes, do you believe that there is a possibility that there is a shadowy or a secret scientific community that is operating out there that perhaps might be they might be behind NASA or something like that?
I have to be very careful when I talk about this.
I'm just asking you to speculate with me.
I don't know, but I'll tell you this. The circumstances surrounding the Mars Observer mission are so full of suspicious occurrences and strange activities, such as reputable scientists like Dr. Malin, who is certainly a skilled scientist, putting up arguments that are just plain, ordinary, ridiculous. In fact, that's largely what stimulated me to write a lot of this, as I started reading what Dr. Malin was writing, and from a just a simple logical point of view, it's so full of holes that you stand with your mouth open looking at this.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggest that it's difficult to account for why a skilled scientist would give out with such faulty arguments unless there was something else going on behind the scenes.
Okay. Let's take a call. We've got Brother John from our affiliate in Santa Cruz, KNRY. Are you there, Brother John?
Yes, I am.
Good evening. Thanks for calling.
Yes, it's a very interesting program, as usual. I have a question for Dr. McDaniel.
Surely.
Can he bring us up to speed a little bit on the latest developments with the regarding the possibility of a civilization that's been discovered on the moon and any connection?
I knew that was what you were going to say.
We're on the final stretch of the program this evening with Professor Stan McDaniel. And just before we went to break, Brother John asked you to talk about the alleged moon anomalies.
Yes. we didn't even get a chance to talk about the ones on Mars, by the way. but yes, it is true. Now, there's been a long history of reports of anomalous objects and occurrences on the moon. And back in 1967, there was a rash of articles about a discovery from the lunar orbiters of a group of objects they called spires on the moon. the Boeing people who built that craft wrote on this topic. But it was dismissed as nothing important. Over the years, a number of people have done research. There have been some books put out on it. And recently, Richard Hoagland turned his attention to this. Over a period of many, many months, he gradually accumulated the photographs and images that are relevant to this. And he found some very curious things, such as in the NASA catalogs, those images had been partially defaced by felt pens, so that it was harder to tell what you were ordering. But he finally did apparently get a number of the crucial images, and just a couple of weeks ago, he went public, you might say, with them. A geologist named Dr. Bruce Cornett was shown this material in a series of four meetings with Hoagland and wrote a report on it, which, by the way, now I think is circulating around on the networks.
Right, on Paranet. We distributed it the other day.
You have, yes.
Uh-huh.
So you've seen that. And I also talked just last night through Internet with an architectural designer, Robert Fiertek, who lives close enough to Richard Hoagland that he also has visited there and looked at these images.
Okay. Stan, I'm going to have to interrupt you at this point.
Yeah.
We've got to close down the show tonight.
Oh, yeah, we ran out of time.
Yeah, we did run out of time. You've been a very interesting guest, and I probably would like to have you come back soon. We are going to probably address the Cornett report as well sometime in the very near future. But I want to thank you very much, and good luck to you on your endeavor.
Yes, thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure being there.
Okay, thank you. Good evening. Okay, that wraps up our program for this evening.